welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for stopping by today. I hope you're having a pleasant day wherever you are. I'm Henrik, your host, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio. We are based out of Sweden, Scandinavia, in case you are new to the program. And redicecreations.com is our website. Well, we have the tragic shootings in Charleston, South Carolina, happening just about 48 hours or so ago, and we'll definitely cover that in more detail on another program, but you can also follow our news, of course, as more things become known here. But there's a lot of important things to highlight, and especially how the media is both downplaying and, on the other hand, exaggerating certain things to spin it just the way they like in order to maximize the yield. Let no crisis go to waste. As Rahm Emanuel said, it's all about how they're going to use this tragedy. The gun control issue, of course, the mainstream libtard press will use this to denounce guns, first of all. It's the guns' fault, despite that this obvious mentally ill kid who is accused of these horrible murders couldn't actually legally carry one. So even if there were gun laws in place, or if there was no guns allowed in Charleston, how would this have prevented what happened? How would a gun-free zone, as I believe this church was, how would that have prevented this from happening? Well, the obvious answer is that it wouldn't. I think beyond the gun issue, the other item to them that's most important is the so-called white supremacy question, and of course how this can be pegged collectively now on racist white America. You know, Salon, Huffington Post, MSNBC, etc., they immediately turn to the SPLC to blame, not only the Ku Klux Klan, but American patriots, sovereign citizens, anti-government advocates, white nationalists, etc. They throw this at anything they don't like in order to tarnish their reputation. This is what they do. And oh, also, I saw that South Carolina has a Confederate flag at their state house still. Uh-oh. It's a flag that represents white people wanting to bring back slavery, right? Yeah, I mean, I'm serious. This is how one-dimensional the reasoning is. They believe that somehow Southern heritage is all about slavery and nothing else. And they will certainly mention nothing about the economic incentives for the Northern War of Aggression, as the Southerners actually call it. The Civil War was about a whole lot more than just slavery. But, you know, these are not times of historical accuracy. I mean, it never really is, but it's about taking something horrible and utterly senseless, like this despicable shootings of nine innocent black people in a church, and then associating that with everyone that you don't like in an attempt to tear down and destroy. They piggyback their own selfish political agendas on something that is so despicable, like these killings. That's how uncouth and immoral the mainstream media and their lackeys really are. So all of this is, smeared together into a sticky bundle of joyous media slime, and then appropriately the drugs and Suboxone, all that kind of usage that was associated with this kid is conveniently avoided. Did you see that during his transportation, when it was taken from one place to another, that his, his nerves were kind of twitching, strange facial expressions, and his tongue was twitching, and he had something kind of covered white all over it, like he was severely dehydrated. That's a possibility, of course, but I don't know. He might even have had a handler, for all we know, another plant, basically. We just don't know at this point. We'll have to see what more information comes out, and then we have to look at that information and see if that's trustworthy in itself, because just because it's documented or not documented doesn't mean it's the truth, of course. So it's important that we honor the truth wherever it may lead. We are going to talk about something completely different on today's program with a guest who joins us from the UK, Matthew Tate. Matt is a former member of the BNP, the British National Party. He has stood for election at local and national level on many occasions and faced persecution in the press and at work. Well, he left the BNP in 2010 and went on to start Western Spring, and we'll speak more about that during this program. But our main focus here today is on Europe, the future of Europe, and positive solutions and strategies, how to lead and reach out to all those who wish to play a meaningful and successful part in a new century of European achievement. But we're going to start to diagnose the problems, the challenges that we face, and pinpoint the sources of our malaise and provide reasons why none of us should give in to pessimism and hopelessness. Well, thank you for coming on with us today, Matt. It's good to finally speak with you. Hope you're doing well today.
Thanks, Henrik. Yeah, it's great to be on the show. As I said to you, I'm an avid listener, so it's exciting to be actually on the show.
Well, you did a very good talk at AMRIN, American Renaissance, this year, 2015, that was, inspiring and really striking at the heart of what can be done about the predicament that we find ourselves in, and the fact that we all not only can, but must do more if we are to keep Europe and remain who we are. I don't think it can escape anyone at this point of what actually is happening, unless, of course, you are hopelessly asleep or in severe denial, like many unfortunately are. But we were close to going to AMRIN, by the way. The offer kind of came in a bit late, and we had some things in the way, so it didn't work out this time. But it would have been great to meet you and all the others there in person, something way too few of us actually do, at least at this stage. And this is something we want to get to a bit later also, actually. But it's, as I said, it's good to have you here on the program. Matt, what would you like our audience to know about you that haven't heard about you or your work before?
Well, I came into being involved in political things when I was 18. I joined the BNP at that time when the BNP was just starting to really become very successful. For any of your foreign listeners, the BNP is the British National Party. At that time, it was a real force for the future. Well, that's the way it seemed. And every week we were getting election results showing that we were getting large votes, ever growing, and then suddenly breaking through and getting people elected in councils and later in the London Assembly and also then to the European Parliament in, I think, 2009, which really was the crowning achievement of the group. So my involvement in the party was sort of between the ages of 18 and 24, so very much my sort of adult formative years. And I was involved as a local organizer, so organizing local members and getting speakers to come and then organizing campaigns in the elections. I've stood for local election many times. I've stood for parliament in my home county. I have been involved in many other election campaigns where people have been elected, such as in East London, in Barking and Dagenham, where I spent a considerable amount of time working. During my time in the BNP, I really tried to push to overcome the stigma attached to that kind of a identitarian party and try to show people that we were good people and that they had a shared vision of their future that we had and that we could deliver that future. And one of the things I really tried to do was to associate the party with the areas that I live in. So at that time, the BNP was winning in areas that were often a bit considered to be a bit rough, so perhaps very formerly industrial areas that had were no longer very strong industrial areas where there was high unemployment, and areas that weren't considered to be high status. So I live in a sort of commuter belt territory just outside of London in the county of Buckinghamshire. So I wanted to have the party associated in these areas, and we did very well. We got 16% in several different local wards, even 18% in one of the wards in Windsor, which is a big tourist destination because that's where the Queen lives. And Windsor Castle is the biggest occupied castle in the world, I believe. So a part of what I really wanted to do is to show people, is to really sort of stamp the message of moral traditional decency, of British identitarianism in my local area, and try and raise the status and the standing of the party in people's minds. I left the party in 2010. Basically, a lot of people were leaving at that time, and it was mainly due to internal ructions within the party. Really, it just became obvious that the leadership weren't going to be taking the party in the right direction, and it was a very sad decision. I'd given a lot of my time and effort in my young years to achieving things with that party. But since then, I've gone on to do my own projects, which I'm very excited about, including the Western Spring project and also the Legion Martial Arts project. So those are things that I'm sure we can talk about as the show goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the main issues here we're going to get into today is basically what can be done about many of the problems we face. Solutions is absolutely key, you know, how to organize, how to pull together in such a way that we can start making some real change, be that political or metapolitical or on an organizational level, what have you. And, of course, you have a lot of experience already in this, which is great. But before we get there, I think for the sake of our listeners as well, let's just kind of diagnose the problems a little bit so that our audience as well understand kind of what you're coming from and what some of the main problems that you see. This is certainly a big topic. We could spend hours and hours and hours on this alone, but let's just kind of run over some of the more fundamental points of how you see what is wrong, if you will, Matt.
Sure. Well, I suppose in my more mature formed outlook on the world as it is today compared to, say, 10 years ago, the way that a lot of people, I think, diagnose the situation is rather to surface level. And they tend to focus far too much on not the real causes, but more the symptoms. So I would say one of the symptoms of the problem that we have is mass immigration from the third world that is causing cultural disputes and population disputes and competition over resources in all over Western Europe. That to me isn't really the cause of the problem. There is a deeper cause. There are a number of other sort of very obvious problems like the loss of sovereignty to the European Union and things to do with just the general decadence of society, which frankly is reaching new levels on a weekly basis at the moment with all of this kind of social justice warrior kind of stuff on the internet, which is really, really disturbing.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, I suppose a part of my diagnostics is that those things just aren't really that important. I mean, how many people are really interested in Caitlyn Jenner and transgenderism or whatever? And then the latest thing which seems to have hit the headlines this week, and that's transableism, where people are literally cutting off their own legs can become disabled because they want people to feel sorry for them. These people are psychopaths, and that might be natural. It might also be triggered by, you know, the chemicals that float around and the medications that are doled out by GPs without proper understanding. But these things, again, as I say, they're so minority interest. I mean, society has got so much bigger issues. And I think understanding really the fundamentals of what's causing these symptoms is exactly the first place that we need to start. Now, on Western Spring, we carried what I consider to be a very, very important article. And this was an article about the way that the money system works. Now, a lot of your listeners, this isn't going to be new to them to hear that the money system is where the problem lies. But I don't think I've ever heard the diagnosis that I'm about to give you articulated by anybody, except in this article that we carried on Western Spring. And basically, the guy who wrote this article, he is from an IT kind of background, and he knows all about programming, and I think he's probably a bit of a programming genius. He effectively describes the system that we live in, this kind of matrix that is at the foundation of all the systems that create this complex society. It is kind of like, I think the term he's used is a heuristic algorithm. So there is a system in place that is like a computer program. So if we think about it like that. Now, what he's really meaning is that if you take, for example, a big corporation, if we take, for example, a supermarket. Now, the supermarket exists to make profit, and there are other supermarkets out there competing with it. If that supermarket can't work out the way to make the most profit, then the other supermarkets will become stronger in comparison. If that continues as a trend, then the supermarket that is the weakest will die. So it's a kind of survival of the fittest environment that business is existing. Now, the supermarket has to deliver these profits on a very short-term basis. So most of these kind of corporations aren't interested in long-term profits. They're not really interested in what's going to be good for the world in 10 years' time. And there was a report that was brought out recently by a group of investors in the US, and we can link to this if you like from the published podcast. And Warren Buffett was one of the people who was represented in this statement. And they were basically saying that they are very concerned about the decreasing time frame that corporations are interested in. It's now got down to the stage where the only thing that a corporation is interested in at any one time is the amount of profit that they make for their next quarterly statement. So every 3 months they make these quarterly statements, and whether people invest money in that corporation or not by buying stocks and shares is determined by how well they're doing on that quarterly basis. So all these corporations are being absolutely watched like hawks, and they have to deliver. Now, what happens if the leaders of those companies don't deliver that maximum profit? Of course, they are pushed out and replaced by someone who will deliver the maximum amount of profit. And that's the way that these systems work. So if you're not, as the leader of one of these corporations, if you are not finding the ways to make that short-term profit, then you are going to be replaced. And that effectively reinforces itself. So in a way, the corporation is in charge, because if you aren't feeding what the corporation wants, if you're not feeding into the computer program what the computer program needs, then it will find some other way of feeding itself. And the contention that was put forward by the writer on Western Spring in this particular article was that the people who control, who ostensibly control these organizations, they don't have any control over them. They are systems that have been started a long time ago in history with companies just looking to raise funds to push their companies forward and to innovate new products. So to basically get people to invest in them instead of saving their monies and tucking it away into a bank account or into a pile of gold under their bed. And to do that, they created shares. And since the issuance of shares, the systems have become more and more complicated. And the people who run these big companies now, they don't really own the companies for the most part. There are very few large privately owned companies. They are almost all public limited companies where people own shares. So really, it's the difference between ownership and control that has caused the runaway corporatism and profiteering that we are suffering the consequences of. So the people in charge of these corporations, they need to make profit. So what do? They want cheap workers. So they go and they find cheap workers. They bring cheap workers here. They outsource the jobs that can be done elsewhere to Pakistan or China or Taiwan. So the things that we are feeling in our lives are the symptoms caused by the source of a system that was created for something that was perfectly valid that has become out of control. Now, the people who run the company, they can't do anything about it because they don't own the company.
Right.
The people in charge of the company don't own it. They don't have control of the brakes. The people who own the company don't have control of the brakes. Effectively, there are no brakes. We have created computer-based systems in all these different corporations that are designed to find ways of making short-term profit no matter what, without almost any restriction.
And, you know, even at this stage, increasingly artificial intelligence is actually slowly taking over the stock market. It's begun with these, you know, micro transactions and things like this to handle it on such a speed that it will be beneficial. But it's in reality, it's already in the hands of machines or algorithms, if you will, which is, of course, means it's literally out of control right now.
Yeah, you're completely right. That's another good point. That was actually cited in this same report that I believe Warren Buffett was representing, certainly being a representative of, talking about the short-term nature of corporate profit profiteering. But all of these different things are basically adding up to a very complex economic system that we exist within that has become more powerful than the people, effectively.
Yeah.
So it's like a gigantic snowball that's built up over the years, and no one has the brakes. No one can seem to do anything about it. It's a system that just exists to feed itself constantly. But unfortunately, it's also a system that cannot go on forever. It only survives upon being able to profit more and more and more. And there will get to a stage where it just cannot continue to feed itself. So it's kind of like a rolling snowball that's got absolutely huge, but at some point it's going to go off a cliff. Now, the people might kind of like the idea of that happening, but the people who are going to suffer is all of us, because where is all of our money? And that kind of takes us back to the point I wanted to go into a bit more, and that is who actually owns the shares in these companies, who owns the supermarket, who owns all of these computer programs effectively who are looking for profit. And I've looked into that. Actually, it does differ from country to country. In the US, most shares are owned by households. So actually, it's the US citizens personally who own the shares of the company. So they effectively have bets on the corporations to do well. And to do well, the corporations have to screw over the people.
So that's excellent. The situation. Excellent.
Now, it's a bit different in the UK, and it's an interesting point just to make. Actually, the majority, the actual largest group of share ownership in the UK is foreign investors. So you could almost see that as being worse, because in a way, in a theoretical situation, Americans could say, okay, we recognize this system is bad, we're not going to buy shares anymore. And that would kind of solve the problem. I mean, that's not going to happen, but at least in theory, that is possible. Over in the UK here, households own only something like 10% of the shares that have been issued. Therefore, if everyone got together and said, we're not going to own shares anymore, it wouldn't really matter. It's, we are effectively, the corporations who are screwing over the people in the UK are not owned by households in the UK. They are owned by foreign investors. Of course, a significant number of the other shares are owned by pension schemes and investment companies. And of course, where does this money come from? We're the ones buying insurance. We're the ones who invest our pension schemes in the stock market so that we can retire comfortably. We're effectively constantly betting on a system to provide us with a future. But at the same time, you know, with one hand is giving us the retirement and the future that we want, and with the other hand is stabbing us in the back.
Yeah, it's really scary when you think about it. And this idea that it's kind of, I mean, it isn't really out of our control to a certain extent. There are things, as you said, that can be done about these things in certain countries, at least in the U.S. But that doesn't discount, obviously, that this meets up with other agendas along the way. People personally profit from these kinds of issues as well. We don't necessarily have to take the view that, oh, yeah, it's, you know, it's a genocidal conspiracy that's in effect, and that's where we should look. But it doesn't mean that these various agendas kind of meet up with each other, and what we see happening right now is kind of what we're getting, because we're not smart and savvy to it, and we're just not, we haven't decided that we want to do something about it yet, right?
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. I'm certainly very hopeful for the future, and I think I can give any number of examples about why we should be hopeful. I think understanding the system that I've just described, I mean, to me, that is inspiring and kind of encouraging, because you see all these websites that are such full of doom. I've seen any number of websites where I've thought, well, there are significant elements of this that is true, but I just don't want to believe it, because you have just created a situation where I have to accept that the world is so much more awful than I could possibly have imagined.
Right.
I don't want to live in that world. I want to stay motivated. But that's not to say that you should be blinkered or put your head in the sand. It's just that it's not completely true that way. It isn't a complete conspiracy. The power of society is not all tied up with one group of people of any different kind. It is a very complicated situation. And yes, there are different groups out there, such as, let's say, the secret societies of, for example, different ethnic groups who are working together to benefit from the system, that kind of thing, as well as religious groups like, say, for example, the Catholic Church, who have their own agendas, and everyone has their own agenda in the end. But I don't think we can say, you know, it's the Rothschilds, they own everything, they are, you know, they are the be all and end all, and there's nothing you can do about it. Or that, you know, the CCTV cameras are watching you wherever you go, and you can't do anything about the situation you're in. We have to absolutely refrain from being in that kind of negative situation.
Well, you know, don't many take that position just because it kind of, it is defeatist, and to a certain extent there is a kind of a weird comfort, I think, that people get in that, because it means basically, well, you know, whatever I do, it won't matter anyway, so it kind of inhibits action and change, basically.
Yeah, well, I was hoping to get a bit more into the mindsets of people that I've sort of been in contact with through effectively what is known as nationalism. I don't really consider myself to be a nationalist anymore per se. Not that I'm against nationalism in itself, it's just that nationalism has so many connotations that I really want to move away from. I see myself as being part of a group of sort of post-nationalist people who are sort of becoming something else, which perhaps doesn't yet have a name.
Right.
But you're completely right. There is a negative mindset amongst many people who are looking for problems. And I think that's one of the problems that the BNP suffered. It had very often a message of victimhood and negativity. And it attracted people who wanted an excuse for why they'd been the victim of society. And in many cases, these people weren't really victims of society as such. They were just not very successful people. They had personality problems. They weren't very disciplined, or they had issues with vanity or other personality problems. But they wanted to project that onto something external so they could make themselves feel better. So there is this therapeutic side to being in this kind of a movement. And I think that's been one of the biggest problems of bringing people together and doing anything useful is these kinds of people. So in a way, we have to be very careful with the kind of people that you allow to get involved with any particular group.
Yes, exactly. Now, obviously, the money system rules a lot of things. A lot of things consequently kind of unfolds after this. Now, is there anything else you want to say in terms of diagnostics about some of the other areas that are kind of under the umbrella of what we've just talked about? Or do you want to kind of move along and talk about what actually can be done about some of this?
Well, we've got plenty of time. So in terms more of the diagnostics, I think that I can highly recommend the interview that you did recently with Greg Johnson. I completely follow the presentation that he made, which I think is largely stems from Professor Kevin McDonald, just about the way that we as a race have evolved on the edges of ice plates, and we have this particular mentality. We're very welcoming. We are individualists, so we consider everyone to be just like us, and it's just not the case. There are other groups in the world who are much more predatory, who are much more tribally minded, and they certainly are doing well for themselves in the situation that we've created. We've created a system whereby everyone can be treated as an individual and everyone is considered to be the same. And it's not the case. And when you create a playing field that's like that, and we play by the rules that no one else does, then we are constantly being weakened in our position. So there's elements of that at play as well. I think there's any number of things that are going on. I also think that two world wars have decimated the leadership cadre of the European peoples.
Yeah.
The First World War probably more than anything else. Also, I think there's been a phenomena of change in the way that society works that we're still trying to catch up with. I'm trying to think of the author who said this. I think it was Thomas Carlyle, but someone, I think, corrected me on that recently. But it was a very salient point, and that was when he was asked, what is your opinion on the French Revolution? He said, this is only in the 20th century, it's too early to tell.
Yep,
and
that's
I think
right.
that is going to be so true of so many things. I mean, if we were to say, what do you think about the industrial revolution? I think it's in some ways it's still too early to tell the full repercussions of those huge social changes where people were taken from the countryside, forced into working in industrial mining situations. And we still live with a legacy of that in industrialized countries where people are still living in the same houses in the same areas, but often with much less employment opportunities. I also think that the stuff that you talk about with regards to the disruption of hormones, the biological demasculinization of males in countries where we have a lot of petrochemical products is very important and still yet to be fully understood. So diagnostically, I don't want to get too bogged down, but I think that if you understand the way that money works and the way that corporations work, if you understand the way that races are different from each other and operate in different ways, then I think that that's a good enough place to then to use as a platform to decide what it is you need to do to solve the problem.
Well, exactly, and just to emphasize that, I mean, so much have changed so fast, and yet despite all this, we remain who we are, despite the many people think that we can just we're going to change overnight and everyone else is going to change overnight and we're all, you know, this tabula rasa, clean slate. We can, whatever we bring on environmentally is who we become, but that's not true, of course. But it's like we've been hacked to a certain extent. Our altruism have been hacked. And despite all these things, Matt, that you bring up, interestingly enough, it's in this time, it's really not about the rest of the world or other agendas or what everyone else is trying to do or get out of the situation, what have you. It's really, at the end of it, I think, in a way, it's still up to what we do and what we don't do and how we respond to this. There's so many directions that this can take if we just know how to get together, how to organize, and how to effectively turn this around. And so we basically can just kind of dive right into it. I mean, yeah, I know that you have a lot of experiences from politics, obviously, and this is an important area. But there's a whole other field to this as well, which is about the metapolitical or the idea of you know, businesses and attitudes and you know, role, being a role model and things like this that are going to be effective in basically steering the direction towards another side. So, you know, there's so much to talk about here. So basically anywhere where you want to begin, Matt, let's dive into it.
I think the first place to start here is just to understand what potential there is, because I still believe that some people, even with the diagnostics that we've got, they have such low morale. I think a part of the low morale that we're suffering from is this separation that's occurred between us and our history. I don't think we really understand who we are anymore, and that's been done partially deliberately. Now, when we look at our history, we realize that we are the kind of people, and probably the only kind of people who have ever existed in known history, who can visualize something that has never existed, ever, and then go out and seek how to create it. This is how all the great inventions have happened, this is how the great civilizations and societies have begun to form, and how we've gone from Europe to different continents and started it all over again. It's that ability to see something that doesn't exist and then go and make it happen, which is just unique to us. And that should be something that's taught to all of our kids in school, and how important that is. I mean, that is the highest form of consciousness and life that exists in this world, the ability to do that, as far as I'm concerned. I think with that understanding, you realize that it is in our control. We have the potential to do fantastic, amazing things. And if only we can stand together and be positive, then the world is our oyster. Some of the experiences that I had, just in regards to more mundane things in the environment that we exist within, in the times when I was campaigning for the BNP, I would go door to door, knocking on every single door. I'd go up to people in the street who were just walking along with their shopping bags, hurrying along to go home. And I would just stop them and I would speak to them. And you do build up a kind of a knack for how to approach people and to talk to them and to get them on side. And the number of people who agree completely is just phenomenal. I would say, in my experience, when you go and you speak to very normal English people in the places that I've been to, you could expect for probably more than half people to agree with all of the things that we believe in that wouldn't require them to have some expert academic knowledge. So they would be completely in agreement. Immigration has gone way too far. There was a recent poll that showed that 85% of British people wanted mass immigration into this country to either completely stop or to be almost completely stopped.
Yeah.
85%. Now, wow. We're probably only 85% white. So that's basically every white person. I also had I think in this same poll, they found that something like 25% of British people would support a policy that was not only directed at recent immigrants, but also immigrants who were born here, who are second generation, and effectively, humanely encouraging them, but forcing them to go back to the countries of their origin. So that's 25% of the country would support something that strong.
Wow.
You know, that is, you know, we might even stop short of that in what we need to do to safeguard the future of our people and our civilization. But people are still prepared to go into that kind of territory. And a lot of people wouldn't tell a pollster that they would believe in that. So for me, that kind of shows you the environment that is there that can be tapped into. And in my experience, it's completely true. You go around and you talk to people and they're almost relieved that you've come to their door and they see your BNP rosette or your BNP leaflet and they just think, oh, finally someone who I can open up to and just tell them everything that I've been wanting to say for the last 30 years. And I've had that, you know, yeah. People pouring their hearts out to me and just being so grateful that I was there, wanting to shake my hand. I've had people forcing £20 notes into my hand and giving donations on in the streets. by people begging for signs to put up in their houses so they can tell everybody that they've, you know, that they're supporting the cause. I've seen kids running around with BNP written on their school T-shirts in marker pens, running around just running around the streets. And another really good story is from the East London area of Dagenham, which at the time it was built was the largest council estate in Europe, and it was built to house the workers of the Ford car factory, which no longer really operates there. But this old boy had been there his entire life. He was a real Cockney, you know, out of the East End, moved out to Dagenham, been there his entire life, and has seen not only his first home in the East End of London be completely ethnically cleansed of white people, but he's seen effectively the same thing beginning to happen in Dagenham. And he had hardly any money at all, but he insisted on making a donation. And because he made the donation, I thought, I'm going to send him a little pin badge, which everyone used to love these little pin badges. So I sent him one in the post, and he'd send back another check. And I'd send him another badge, or I'd send him a thank you letter, or I'd send him something every time that he wanted to make a donation. And he would always send another donation. So I thought at one point, should I just stop replying to him so that he doesn't bankrupt himself? I was really getting worried this guy was just going to give everything. He was just so excited by it and so moved and inspired by it all. But there's all these kinds of people out there. And, you know, our people are so giving and they're so trusting and they're so warm and welcoming. And they're just craving leadership, but they're not as clever as some of our academic writers, and you know, they don't have a real understanding of the world. The complexities of the world as it is now is just beyond them in their lifetimes to get to grips with. It will be beyond the grips of beyond the realm of probably 95% or more of the population to ever have any real understanding of the way the world works. So we kind of have to understand that, and then we have to try and work out how we can move them. The liberals do this; they just move them and they get the votes in the right box, and they get people to behave in the way that facilitates the system to continue in the way that they want it to go. So we need to effectively have a way that we can reach out to our people who are craving something new. They are craving our message, but we have to do it in a clever way. But I would say to people, if you're in any doubt about the possibility for us to win, to do well, then cast that aside, because my experience of being on the streets, certainly in my country, and I truly believe this is the same everywhere, is our people have a hunger, a real burning hunger that's only growing for what we have to offer.
Let me ask you, I mean, you've spoken about the fall of BNP, if you will, and there are a lot of reasons for this as well. But if we just look at the latest election in the UK, obviously UKIP, the only other party really that is addressing immigration, and they did pretty good, but despite this, they only got one seat. There's something which I don't understand with the election system in Britain there, but there seems to be a willpower then from many people, from many native British people, but yet there isn't at this stage much political options for you guys in Britain. Is the solution political? Is there going to come a political party along that's just going to, you know, fix everything for you guys? Or where do we need to look, do you think, to start turning things around at this stage?
Well, that's a very good question. On the subject of UKIP, I would also say that's another great sign of the appetites of people. I mean, UKIP were portrayed in the media as effectively being a mixture of sort of fruitcake lunatics and extreme racists, some of whom have links to neo-Nazi groups and were doing Nazi salutes. You know, even if they weren't, but these pictures and stuff were printed as if they were.
Right.
But they were really, really given a hard time in the media. And they still did really well. Looking back to the European elections, which I think were last year, UKIP won. Now, there has never been an election in Great Britain where any other party except one of the three main parties has won. Now, we've got more than 200 years of this kind of general election, and no other party except Labour, the Conservatives, or the old Liberals, basically, or one of their prime names, have won those elections. UKIP have come along and have blasted them out of the water in a national election. Now, people don't always take the European elections as seriously as they take a general election, but no party except those three has ever won any kind of election here. The fact that UKIP won, to me, just shows that something is really changing and stirring here. Now, UKIP did underachieve very slightly in the general election, but that was mostly because of the manipulation in the media. They really built up the threat of Ed Miliband, Red Ed, being in Downing Street as the Prime Minister, backed by the Scottish National Party. And that really sent chills down the spines of people in Middle England. I even considered voting Conservative just to prevent that from happening. You know, that's how powerful their message was.
Yeah.
But I think that there is probably a hardcore of probably something like 5 to 10 million people in this country who are at the stage where they want radical anti-immigration, radically pro-British, traditionalist representation in Parliament right now. So that's a massive, massive potential out there that it's not really tapping into. But in answer to your question, is a party going to come along? I really don't think that's really the way it's going to happen. The situation with UKIP is the establishment haven't managed to destroy them yet, but I think they will at some point. Even if UKIP did become the majority in Parliament, they probably would be prevented from doing the things that they wanted to do by some other means. In the end, it's the money that makes the world go round, not the politicians in Parliament. So personally, I'm not looking for a party to come along. Lots of little parties have formed over here in the absence of the BNP, and they're not going anywhere. They basically may as well not exist. Like I said in my Amren talk, they may as well not exist because they are literally a few people who meet very rarely and do almost nothing. Although they're very well-meaning, and I think well of them. The way that it's going to go, I think, is that we have to offer people more. We aren't doing enough to get people to come and live lives that add their weight behind our cause. That's what liberalism has done. Everything that people do in society now that's normal is extra momentum for the liberal machine. When they shop at the supermarkets, when they watch the television, things they talk about when they're sitting around the newspaper in the morning, basically every single thing they do, even when they go to work, they are continuing to push the liberal system that is destroying them further. And they're reaping the benefits of that. So what we need is a much more holistic approach to the situation. And that's really what Western Spring is set up to do. It's set up to understand the situation in the world with the right kind of diagnosis, as we've talked about, to understand that the party isn't going to come along and save the day. Parties and politics follow culture and reality on the ground. So Western Spring is very much about bringing people together and creating a new kind of culture, a parallel culture or a kind of parallel society where we live together by more traditional values, but still within the same geographic space. And in doing so, we can create the reality of a different community. We can create the reality of a different type of people. And in creating that, we can then have a political party that can come along and really get strong support and become elected. And we'll get representation that way. So, for example, one of the projects that Western Spring has sponsored is known as Legion Martial Arts Club. Now, what Legion Martial Arts Club is, it's the part of our strategy which is to get people together and do outside adventurous activities. Something that's very popular over here at the moment. I think a lot of young men particularly are feeling very, very kept in and very restricted in their opportunities in life. Many of them are a bit like some of these kids who were shipped out in the Blitz from London, and they've never seen a sheep, never seen a fully grown oak tree.
Right.
And you know, when they get the opportunity to go to one of the national parks, climb mountains, swim in waterfalls, do archery, learn how to defend themselves, have full contact boxing matches with their friends, get around the fire and drink mead from a Viking horn and swear oaths to each other and make boasts about things that they've achieved, and learn how to do things like skinning rabbits, cooking your own food. This is something that really, really has attracted a whole new group of people. And most of the people who come to these events weren't involved in the BNP or ever in politics. And I don't think they'd ever be that interested in sitting in a room listening to a talk or getting involved in elections. So it started to tap some of that untapped potential out there. Of all those people who are in the country who want to be involved in some way in what we're doing, but they're just not political animals. They're not politically minded, and they don't want to hear talks. They don't want to talk about voting. This is the kind of thing that they can get involved in. So a part of what we as the leaders of this movement, whatever that is, need to provide has to be a lot more varied than a political party. One of the things we've suffered from in England is the fact that the political party over the past 10 years or so has done so well. In the States, it's not so much that way. Political parties are very tough to get off the ground over there. And I think that they have many more resources. So they've got AMRIN, they've got the National Policy Institute, they've got Countercurrents, and they've got VDare, and much more locally based groups, even if it's something more mundane like rifle associations and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Don't really have any of that over here. It's always right. Seen about a political party or nothing. And sadly, at the moment, it's become about nothing. But in that vacuum, Western Spring and the Legion Martial Arts are picking up supporters left, right, and centre. And you know, our message of a more holistic approach to society is really taking off.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the biggest questions is, of course, is what do we offer people? What is better with what we do or what we have or offer, if you will, than what the convenience of the liberal world offers people? I mean, because we have the idea of cultural Marxism, that this was injected into our society as a cultural revolution, and many people, they went for that. They you know, whether we like it or not, they offered something. But the question is how to go beyond that, to go beyond that this is just a kind of a lifestyle choice, if you will, just as people go, I don't know, emo or goth or whatever, and that, because that might change tomorrow again. So, you know, What is there at the core that we can appeal to get people to see that there is a better way, which is not going to lead to the destruction of our world?
Yeah, well, I think lifestyles is a very interesting and important thing to discuss. As you say, emos and, you know, rockers and whatever other things have cropped up as lifestyles over the years come and go. But I do think that we have to be a lifestyle. I mean, I wouldn't say that we need to go beyond the lifestyle. I just say we need to be a true lifestyle, something that isn't just something that you try on for a while and then you take off and you wear a different jacket the next week. It's got to be something that you do genuinely adopt for life, and it has to offer you something that can become your life. Now, my experience of these groups is a bit limited, but I've been trying to find groups who create lifestyles for their supporters and are successful. Because it's always disappointed me how people are always asking me, for example, about, oh, what do you think about the EDL? Because I don't care about the EDL. Why aren't you asking me about what I think about some successful group somewhere and how we can emulate them? Because that's the real question. Now, for me, a really good example of a group that's done really, really well is the Mormon Church. Now, the Mormon Church have, I think, around 7 million members nationally, even though the religion was only founded in, I think, the 1840s. Most of that growth has happened in the 20th century. They have 80,000 full-time, professionally trained missionaries out there right now. 80,000. In the history of the church, they've had over 1 million people have served missions. And this is where they go away for 2 years. They spend 2 years at the age of, I think, 19 to 21, usually, where they're just out there trying to attract new recruits. And my understanding is that they struggle, and if a person in 2 years can find one sincere recruit in that time, that they've done quite well. So they really struggle.
Sorry to interrupt, Matt, but I actually encountered two of these in this kind of industrial area in Gothenburg in Sweden one day. It was just hilarious. And it was like, what the hell is this? You know, they were out there, they were talking, and they were, you know, we got into some philosophy and they explained to me and whatnot, but it's like, but that dedication is extraordinary if we compare it to what most people do in the West today, you know?
Yeah, well, this is, I think, really the absolute key point for discussion amongst people who are interested in playing a part for the good of the cause, and particularly in leading in that regard, because we can see around us people who are prepared to give their lives over to make huge personal sacrifices for something that they believe in, yet we are completely unable, it seems, to mobilize any significant number of people beyond, say, a few dozen here and there,
yeah,
who will make any kind of dedication at all, even making more than, say, £100 donation to the party or group, or to spend an entire week doing something. I mean, I've never heard someone spending an entire week full time doing something for the cause. Just unheard of, but this is what the Mormons do. For 2 years, they have six days a week. They are professional out there missionaries, knocking on doors, accosting you in the street. And the level of dedication for that is so impressive. So impressive. And they go off and they can't speak to their families for 2 years. It's not even just that they go for 2 years. Usually they go to another country. And while they're in that country, they cannot visit their parents, or their parents visit them for 2 years. They're only allowed to speak to their parents about once a month. It's very, very, very tough on them. And all they've got to show for it is people who don't want to talk to them in the street in Gothenburg. So, you know, if you imagine we had 80,000 people who just decided we are going to go and be professional missionaries for the cause, and we're going to go and talk to people about the need for them to change the way that they live their lives for the benefit of themselves and their children. You know, the amount of people we'd have interested in that is going to be probably something like 1,000 times more, or more than 1,000 times more, the level of interest in that than talking about Mormonism. People just aren't really interested in talking about sort of what's considered to be a very strange American Protestant sect. So the question for us is to work out, why are we not dedicated enough? And this is a question that I pose to people at AMREN. And as I said at AMREN, I'm not just trying to do people down or to make people feel bad about themselves and the dedication that they have shown. It's more because there is so much more that we need to do. And as far as I'm concerned, if we are to achieve the future that we wish to achieve, we have to live up to the standards that we consider ourselves to have. And you know, there's very little low self-esteem within nationalism, in my experience. You know,
yeah.
the British nationalists believe that, you know, Britain is great, and we're putting the great back into Great Britain, and we're part of this glorious European race who took on the world and transformed the world. We invented everything. We are literally full of confidence about our ability. Yet we realize also the acuteness of the situation that we're in, and the danger that both our race and our civilization is currently facing. Yet we're unable to get ourselves to be in any way dedicated. And at AMREN, I gave a few examples for people to sort of mull over in their own sober way, and just to think, do you have a pet dog? Do you have a pet cat? I mean, a pet dog or a pet cat apparently on average costs something like £120 per month in food, in vet bills, cost to buy them, toys, other sort of other general stuff for the upkeep of that pet. £120 per month. How many people can you name who give £120 per month as a donation to the cause in some way? I think you'll probably find it's a very, very few number.
Yeah.
But then there's so many other things. People have got Sky television. A lot of people smoke cigarettes, which is very expensive in Great Britain. It's heavily taxed. Something like 10 cigarettes a day would equate to £150 per month. That's just going up in smoke. The amount of money people spend on trivial things is astounding. But when you then say to them, you know, you need to kind of help us here with this election campaign, it's, you know, it's kind of the shrapnel comes out, as we say, you know, it's the coins that get chucked into the tin rather than the notes. And that isn't always true. I've seen people who often are the least able to afford it giving more than they should, even to the point where I feel like I need to discourage them from doing it for their own good. But back to the great discussion, and that is, why are we not dedicated enough, even though we have a very high regard for ourselves and an acute understanding of the dangers that we face? Now, I think the answer to that is that we are very fragmented, especially geographically. We aren't really living as a community. We aren't a community like the Mormons are. When you're a Mormon, you go to church every Sunday and you see loads of people that you know and all of their kids. If it's someone's birthday, you know about it. You get them a card. If someone's ill, you know about it. You go visit them in hospital. You pay 10% of your income as a tithe to the church in the Mormon church. They have events Monday to Sunday, but every day of the week there is something going on in the Mormon church for you to go and get involved in. They call them firesides and institute, which is for young people, young single adults, where they can get together and mingle and find partners and just have fun and also learn things. They're constantly reaffirming their message to all of these people all the time. But the important thing, I think, is that they are a real serious community. They're very active and they're very dedicated. Unfortunately, we haven't got to that stage. So I would say that my most fundamental answer to the big fundamental question, why are we not dedicated enough, is that we need to form a proper community. We need to get a lot more serious. We need to create a broad lifestyle surround of social events, of educational events that are very locally based and very regular, and really cultivate a genuine, sincere community. And that means the kind of community where you know everyone's name, you see them all the time, you're involved in their lives, you know when their birthday is, you know if they're unwell, your kids play together. You know, that is the kind of community that we need to build. Now, the difficulty for people in our situation is that a lot of people want to hide. So getting significant numbers of people to want to come out of the woodwork and to really be involved is a bit difficult. But that isn't really the case if you're not really an organization. So if you're more just a general getting together of people, then there is no name for the group, for example. So, you know, if it was a BNP thing, then the newspapers could write about it and say, the BNP has an event, so-and-so was there, so-and-so was there. And then, you know, some lefty activists might ring up your job, cause you trouble. But if it's not named, if it's not a political party, then there should be every potential for creating that. And I think that the lack of the BNP, being in a successful stage at the moment, is a great opportunity. I think that we need to take this opportunity to create something that could not really be created properly if the BNP was doing well, when all of the attention would be going towards it and everyone would be trying to push it along in the best way they could. Now is the time when we need to wake people up and realize that they need to stop hiding from their friends, that they can stop hiding from their friends, and that they can come together and that they can form a community that's very much modeled on other groups who have been successful. I'm fed up with trying to hark back to the past and different parties and groups and things that just have gone nowhere, or arguing the toss about whatever local small groups are doing the best at the moment, because none of them are doing anything that's worthwhile in the grand scheme of things. We need to look to successful groups who are doing things that are similar to us, and we need to copy what works. It's only common sense, but it seems to me that so many of the people who are leaders in nationalism have effectively been drawn from the wrong caliber of people in too many cases. Often because, as I said, the party will attract people who have a victim mentality, who haven't got much to lose in their lives. You know, they can afford to get involved in it because they haven't got much to lose. Usually these people, they're not business owners, they're not professionals. They're usually people who are a bit difficult to work with, and they don't really have an understanding of the way that the world works in business or in organizing a charity or in organizing really anything. So you have this movement that's kind of been led by all the wrong people. And it's not to say that they're bad people or their motivations were wrong. It's just that they didn't have enough background in doing similar things. All too many times I've seen someone come along who's just a decent guy and he's given some senior officer responsibility. And unfortunately, they just weren't able to live up to that because they didn't have the knowledge. And sadly, that can really affect them and knock their confidence in the long run, because they don't really want to be in those situations. So one of the things we need to do to make sure that we create a community in the way that I've described is that it needs to be led by the right kind of people. Now, Western Spring has a strategy especially for this. We have identified that that is a key issue. We need to be able to attract and to keep the right caliber of personnel. And effectively what that means is that we as a community have to step up and we have to support them. We have to give them a place and we have to support them so they cannot be attacked by people who are trying to get rid of them from their jobs, et cetera, et cetera. We've got to be that community support. If we want our leaders to come forward, we've got to be the followers. So a part of the Western Spring strategy is to support high caliber people in the movement.
Yeah, I mean, because the question is what it will take, and sure, the media, you know, if they so choose, they could, you know, probably tarnish any group or even, you know, try to make something up and whatever. But I mean, it has to be something with the fact that the majority of people just don't fully comprehend what is at stake, because you'd think that this realization would be motivation enough, or perhaps, correct me if I'm wrong, because the numbers you did mention earlier are of course indicative that people do know what's going on, but somewhere there's a either an information disconnect or there's something that they're scared of what the media will do to them, or that they will demonize them in some way. But I mean, so at some stage, the benefit must outweigh the risks here, and people are like, you know, that's it. You know, I don't care if someone else views it as morally reprehensible and in a propaganda effort to try to, you know, control people politically. At some stage, if they're moved out of that comfort zone, they're going to do what they need to do, I believe. What do you think, Matt?
Well, there is definitely a heroic and valiant spark within our people. And I truly believe that that will be the thing that saves us. Unfortunately, at the moment, that's rather muted. And it's muted for a number of reasons. One is people have been disenfranchised from their own history. They don't understand that they are heroes. They don't understand how powerful they are. They've been sold this idea that they are just another pointless cog in a machine, and they just need to get their head down and carry on working in their administrative job so they can become a senior administrator. They don't really understand what they really are. I think with an understanding and a spark of inspiration, and I've seen any number of times, you know, our history as a race can ignite that spark in an individual, and they become a different person. Now, that is something that we just don't use enough. And we're not going out there with missionary zeal and telling people who they are. That's what we need to do. We need to go out there and reignite that heroic spark in all of our people. And I think that with that right understanding, that they will want to, in many numbers, throw themselves in with what we're doing. Now, I think that we are people who are prepared to take risks, but we're not people who are stupid, who are willing to take stupid risks. Now, I think with political parties in the past, certainly my experience of them is, an intelligent person would often come along and would see, I've got a mortgage, a wife who disapproves, and my kids might get bullied at school. I could lose my job and the mortgage is gone, or I lose the house. Their entire lives could be ruined by getting involved.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, a lot of people take that risk, and it's very, very inspiring to see. But I've seen any number of lives ruined and people losing their wives and that kind of stuff. And the reason that happens is partially because of the bad leadership. People wouldn't mind so much losing things in life if they're gaining somewhere else. But all too often, you're sacrificing and it's not getting you anywhere. And I think the experience over here is people feel a sense of just being drained because they've given a lot. They've risked a lot. They've risked their reputations. They've stood for election. They've been photographed with the BNP rosette on their shirt. And then everything has collapsed and they've got nothing to show for it. So I think there's a kind of fatigue amongst nationalists over here at the moment that still hasn't quite worn off. But as you said, we have that heroic spirit, and with the right approach, I think people will want to come and get involved, and that sense of risk is something that we thrive on. Particularly, I think, for some reason, Scandinavians and British explorers who want to go to the Antarctic and die of frostbite or whatever, but that seems to be the way we like to live. We like to live on the edge.
Right.
But, you know, if you knew that it was going to fail, then you probably wouldn't put your slippers on, you know, in the morning. You'd probably just stay in bed.
Yeah. So it's important that mentality changes and aspiration has to occur, even if it's to a certain extent a kind of a mythology, a willpower, a dedication, which is certain that it will succeed. I mean, there's so much of the psychology. Any sports psychologist to know these things as well. That if you are to win, you know, you can't go in there and think, yeah, maybe, you know, I'm a little weak here and this is not going to work or whatever. It's just, you know, you have to be there 110% and do even more, you know, and that's why this is so, it's so tremendously important here. But let me ask you a little bit more about actually some of the details about the websites, and also, of course, how people can get in touch with you. And I know that you're reaching out to people of trying to get them involved. I mean, we have much more to talk about, and we're going to do that in the second. But before we take a break here in a little bit, tell us a little bit more about the websites, how people can get involved, and how you're looking at, branching out, Matt.
Yeah, sure. Well, on Western Spring, which is westernspring.co.uk, we have a section on there that says About Us. Now, under the About Us section, there are a list of the most significant and important strategic and diagnostic and solution-based articles. So I'd recommend you stop by there. It is a significant amount of reading. But it is a good place to start if you just want to be able to read a bit more about Western Spring. We publish articles on there regularly as well. The website for the Legion Martial Arts Club is legionmac, that's legionmac.org. And you can find us on Facebook as well, on Western Spring and on Legion Martial Arts. The sort of message I'd really like to leave people before we go to the break is that we all need to come together. We can't do this alone. I want to encourage people to not hide from their friends. A lot of people are very paranoid, but they just need to come forward and come and stand alongside your friends, and in that way you'll be able to become much more successful in doing something positive. And it can change your life because you'll become so much more of a positive person because you're involved in something successful. We're not dedicated enough. Each of us need to examine our own lives and the way that we live, the things we spend money on, and need to realize that we need to become more dedicated. We need to stop living the liberal lifestyle. Although we've given up on liberalism and opposed liberalism, pretty much everything we do in our day-to-day lives, be it work, the way we invest our money in pensions, the TV we watch, the different sources of media that we fund, we're still doing more for liberalism than we are for the cause, even if we are giving money and leafleting and doing other things for the cause. We need to be positive. We need to enjoy what we're doing. I mean, this is an opportunity for such great achievements and real personal glory and really building something new. There's so much high potential out there, and our people are craving it. And you can be one of those people who is taking the message to them and receiving that reaction that I've received a number of times of gratitude and pleasure and inspiration. And people need to feel that to understand how powerful that is. That's why I'm involved still now after 12 years of having been involved. We must be able to attract and to keep high caliber people. The personnel in the movement is what makes it. Whoever is in it, that is what it is. Any organization is a combination of the people who are in it. So we need to make sure that we have a way to attract and keep those people. And finally, if we can live deserving lives in the image of the ancestors that we hold in the greatest esteem, with the empire builders, and the explorers to the moon, and to the people who overcame great problems and sufferings in on the frontiers of new places around the world that we've conquered, then in living those deserving lives, we will get the future that we deserve. So in the end, it's simply down to us. As you said, it is in our control. If only we will rise to the challenge. We live in an age that offers us this challenge. And I feel so positive if only people will just come forward. So I say to everybody who likes what I've said and is interested to find out more, I have held a certain amount back that I wanted to hold back because I want people to contact me. So you can do so in contacting me by going and emailing contact@westernspring.co.uk. And you can do that also via the Western Spring website. So my final call really is to people who have liked what I said and they want to be involved in creating this new community, in fostering this positivity and in tapping the potential that there is out there. I'm your guy. Contact me and we'll find you a place.
All right. Very good. Now, obviously, it is marketing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with studying those who have been successful in the past and trying to understand why that has worked. These are still truisms that are part of our psychological makeup and what people are attracted to. And I mean, I think you're right, Matt. I mean, it is to a certain extent about selling the people who are involved, whether we like that or not. It's just what attracts people. And you know, you've spoken eloquently about this in the past, about it's how we, you know, conduct ourselves and the words we choose, how we present ourselves. And all of this is important. I mean, the politicians are doing it for a reason, but the fact is they're doing it so, in my view, they can destroy what we have, you know, and if there's a method by which we can adopt these properties in order to try to not only, you know, preserve it and regain it, but take it to somewhere new, then so be it. You know, we have to do whatever we need to do in order to remain who we are. And it's an incredibly important battle. And I think, as you said before, I think many people do see it, but it's still for some reason too much. They have too much to lose, you know. But let's get in more into that in the second hour, Matt, as we continue here. But let me give you guys the websites once more here before we wrap up with the first segment. It's westernspring.co.uk, and then you also have legionmac.org, Legion martial arts club, I believe it is, .org. That's the website for that, and we'll have the email address that Matt mentioned as well. But yeah, interesting stuff here. Much more to talk about. Looking forward to hearing more what you have to share with us in the second, Matt. So stay with us. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back with more.
This was once Europe, the land of our fathers. They died defending it. Their blood soiled the earth beneath our feet. And yet it flows in our veins to this very day. We have no right to squander it. Not the land, not the blood. We must honor them. That is the quest of our time.
We will continue with Matt Tate in the second segment after a short break. We have a member section where you can hear the second hour of all our programs. Well, you can hear all our shows, of course, back to our start in 2006 here as well. The first hour or first segment is always free. Sometimes we make both segments available for free as well, as much as we can. We spare you from commercial interruptions. We've made it as easy as possible for you to stream or download our shows. You can also catch our program on a number of places. Our YouTube channel, of course, but we're also on Stitcher. We just acquired a SoundCloud account. And, of course, you can subscribe to our podcast feed in iTunes by just clicking the iTunes logo, the button, if you will, from our radio archive. You can also manually add the feed to iTunes or any other feed reader or podcast app. Now, we do three programs a week, and every other week or so, one of these shows is a Radio 314. But when you want to catch the full program, the second hour or second segment, sign up for a membership at redicemembers.com. We have podcast feeds available there, too. Of course, you can catch all the latest programs, or you can go all the way back to 2006. We have our RSS podcast feeds divided up by year as well. So it's really simple to stream or download that way. And, of course, with a feed reader or a podcast app, you can easily get the show to your mobile device as well. It's really simple, and we have the full instructions for you on redicemembers.com. When we return with Matt in the second segment, we'll go even deeper into the solutions part of the problems that we face. We speak about organization, politics, and Matt gives us some further examples from other religious groups that have been very successful at what they do. A solutions-based second hour is coming up, so don't miss it. It's a very good continuation. Join us. Try us out for a three-month subscription, and you can download everything that we have on our site, if you so please. We have more guests in the pipeline. Kurt Doolittle, Justin Garcia, The Right Stuff Guys, Jackson, Victoria Clark, and Christopher Hell, to name a few. But ladies and gentlemen, stay with us as we continue after the break. Thank you for listening.